So good morning and welcome to Narcisse. It is June 22nd, and we have just read our small selection, Deuteronomy 23, verse 10 to 22. Later on, after a little discussion, we will also read Isaiah 1:16 and probably down to verse 27, one of my favorites. And but we're just going to discuss this little selection. Okay, so back up to verse 10. Starts off with a rather strange scenario. But if we read in verse 9, the context is going out to battle. So this is really interesting because we've already had a description of how we're meant to go out to battle earlier in the book of Deuteronomy. Does anyone remember where? My commentary remembers where. It's chapter 10. Let's see if I can find it quickly. Probably can't find it quickly. Let me flip back. Was in my footnotes here. 10:1. So. No. Deuteronomy. No, that's not the Ten Commandments. That's 5. 5. Deuteronomy 5 is Ten Commandments. Okay, no, that's a different one. That's the Ark. Okay, we're gonna get to that reference as well. Sorry, that was the wrong reference, but it is a relevant one.
But there was a whole thing on rules for war.
Okay,
like
yeah.
Where was it?
Well, in 130, there's also, I'm also getting a reference there. I should have written it down better. Okay. Yeah, you can look in chapter 130. This is like the opening speech of Deuteronomy as he's motivating the people to go into the land. And he says, "The Lord your God is about to go ahead of you. He will fight for you just as you saw him do in Egypt and in the desert where you saw him carrying you along like a man carries his son." Okay, so this concept of God going... Haholech lifnechem. He's the one that walks in front of you. He goes in front of you, and he's going to fight for you.
Good morning.
And then also in 31:3. So we just looked at Deuteronomy 1:30. Let's do 31:3 and see what that gives us. "The Lord your God, he passes in front of you. And he will wipe out the nation, these nations before you, and you will inherit." And you will inherit. Joshua will cross before you, just like the Lord spoke. So this is very interesting as well, because you say God's going to go in front of you, and Joshua's going to go in front of you. So there's a nice little equation there, that Joshua is going in the power of the Lord, or representing the Lord. All right. Right on the board, Deuteronomy 23:10 through 22 is our base scripture. And we're following the triennial parasha. So in the days of Jesus, the way that the first five books were portioned out for each Shabbat, and then a little section of the prophets that goes with it. And so we're going to be discussing this little section. It's very short today. A lot of curious little laws. A lot of embarrassing little laws, and then the connection to Isaiah. But I actually find this selection full of nuggets, you could say. So in the context of war, because God is going out to fight with you, what does it mean that God is going in front of you? And the reason I pointed out the reference to chapter 10:1 was that was the instruction for the Ark of the Covenant. And according to Deuteronomy, God is going out for you. Maybe this is referring to the Ark of the Covenant going with you when you fight. And if you remember later on, during the time of the judges, obviously with Joshua, the Ark did go in front of them. And then during the time of the judges, when they were in the battle with the Philistines at Rosh Ha'ain and Afek, and they've come, you've lost what? What were you looking for?
No, I said they lost the Ark.
Oh, they lost it. I thought you said I've lost it.
No.
Yeah, but they called the Ark. They called the Ark out to fight with them because they weren't doing well in the battle. So then, it says, guard yourselves against anything impure. It's interesting because here, we're going to talk a lot about what this all means. The first reference is Venishmarta Mikol Davar Ra. Every bad thing. It's a very generic statement. That word for bad can be evil, it can be yucky, it can be, you know.
We're now back in 23.
Not pretty. Yes, I'm now back in Deuteronomy 23, verse 10. And then the next two verses, I think, are trying to define what that means. So in my English translation, it says, guard yourselves against anything impure. So the Hebrew text doesn't actually say impure, but they're giving you the best translation as they understand it in the next couple of verses. And so we have two instances of something impure. And one, the first one, is a nocturnal emission. So any, good morning. We're talking about nocturnal emissions. Welcome. You came just in the middle of my sentence. So if you think back to the laws of purity and impurity, anything related to humanity and death, what I would say immortality, makes you ceremonially impure. So every time you have sex, every time you have a nocturnal emission, any time you have a woman bleeds, whether it's monthly bleeding or having a baby, all things connected, in fact, to fertility, make you ceremonially impure. And I would say that relates to the bigger picture of God being eternal and immortal and humans being mortal. And part of our mortality is that we die. And that's why we have children. They replace us because we're going to die. We don't live forever, so we have children and they carry on our name. And so it's kind of like that whole, having children is both a symbol of life, but it's also a symbol of the fact that we all die. So in that sense, it's related to this mortality. Anyway, so in this great scheme of things, you have this what we call ceremonially clean, that's representative of God's character, his immortality and his wholeness. And then you have ceremonially unclean, that's, you know, all part of being human. And again, I'll restate it because Christians often confuse uncleanliness with sin. It is not sin. Obviously, you know, you're told to be fruitful and multiply. That's a good thing. But the process, all the stuff that goes with it, renders you unclean. So in this sense, is taking a very specific instance and saying, when you become ceremonially impure, you need to leave the camp. So what does that tell you about the camp in Deuteronomy's eyes?
So it has to stay holy. It has to stay.
The camp is holy.
Holy ground.
Now this is crazy, right? This is a huge deal. Why is the camp holy? Because, you know, this is not, the temple, the Mishkan is not there, right? The tabernacle isn't there.
Holy, doesn't it really just mean separate, set apart?
Apart specially, but for God.
For God, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a special place, so it doesn't need the Mishkan there.
Why would a military camp be set apart for God? Right. And so this whole concept that when Deuteronomy is saying God's going to go to war for you. He's saying, literally, the presence of God is going to be with you in your camp. And you, because of that, your camp is now holy. And so you better not make it dirty with anything. And so the ritual laws apply to the camp as well as the tabernacle. This is like a huge thing. I mean, most armies in the world, when they go off to battle, what do they take with them?
Their idols, their gods.
Sure, gods, okay, well that would be one connection as well. I was thinking women. Right? There's usually an entourage of prostitutes that go along with the warriors. Okay, and we might touch on that in this passage as well.
Or just cooks. You gotta have things done, you know.
Sure.
But there's a difference between...
You can have male cooks.
But even if you don't have male cooks, there is a difference, isn't there, in this instance, between what you call an army of prostitutes, be they male, female, whatever, to service... We're talking about sexual emissions, I'm going to say, to service your
fighting men, right.
Than the guys who are doing the cooking or...
Sure, of course there's a difference.
Cleaning up the camp.
But this is...
I'm thinking what Danny said a couple of weeks ago about the difference or working out the difference between hygiene and ceremonial cleaning.
Right.
And it may be in the next verse we get to the hygiene, I don't know.
Right. So it's starting out with ceremonially clean, but this is really separating Israel's battle lines from every other army in the world, because not only can you not have women to sleep with, even if by chance it happens like you didn't ask for it, just happens in the night, you have to leave the camp.
Right.
I mean, these are really strict procedures for keeping this camp holy, and it's a radical idea. And then, of course, at verse 11 it says...
Because surely it can't be something bad. Say, if you are a soldier, you dreamt about your wife the night before.
Right, exactly. No, it's not bad.
And so again, it's not a sin.
Not a sin, it's not bad, but it is tame. It is ritually impure, and so for that reason, you do what the standard thing is. It doesn't require any kind of sacrifice or anything. You just have to wait to be clean again.
Which makes me think, like...
And wash yourself.
Right, which makes me think, like, that could be a good thing to sort of think about, because, you know, you, like, as, you know, as evangelicals, you sort of do grow up with that.
It's bad.
That is bad, yeah.
Right.
You, especially as a boy, you know, you're taught that it's... That any sort of kind of sexual ponderings are bad, and you're kind of grow up with this like heavy weight of guilt.
Right.
And this could be one of these things where like, okay, no, it's not morally wrong.
It's not morally wrong.
Of course, there can be.
Well, what you do with nature, you can do morally wrong things with it, but it isn't in and of itself wrong.
Right.
But there are things that are part of nature that are in and of themselves impure when it comes to temple sanctity.
But I think where it comes from is from here, is that we've always associated anything unclean with sin. And we've seen this verse about nocturnal emissions, and we said,
we take it as a metaphor, and then we read back our metaphorical understanding in the original and say, that's bad. Do you have a comment back there?
It's a question. Why in verse 10 then does the Torah use the term devour ra?
Anything ra. You're right, because we talked about that. Well, that's the thing. No. It can normally be understood as evil, but this is your most generic word of bad. It can also be understood as ugly. You know? So it's not necessarily a moral bad. It can just be gross.
Right. So the food's not evil, it's just...
It doesn't taste good. Right. Or it looks ugly, or it's not good. But this is part of the whole debate. So yeah, so the first instance is something that is ceremonially unclean. then, I mean, the biggest thing I always tell people to remember is just every kid being born, you become ceremonially unclean because you're in contact with birth blood, which is ceremonially unclean for a month. That's like the longest period of uncleanliness in the whole law. And yet, this is the height of blessing to have a baby, you know? So it's a good thing, and yet it renders you unclean. Jesus was unclean the minute he entered this world. So we know it's not sin. It's humanity. So then the second instance is...
rather than humanity, it's our mortality.
Yes.
It's the fact that we all die.
Right.
And Jesus was born human.
Uh-huh.
And he died. Whether he dies this way or that way is irrelevant. He died.
Mm-hmm.
And so the jump on, I mean, the miracle of the resurrection is that this was a real guy who really died.
And really
and he came
back
to life.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the miracle.
Okay, so our second instance is a bunch of euphemisms. There's going to be a place outside the camp, and you can go out there outside. And you just have to kind of understand what going outside means. And it means to go relieve yourself, I have in the English. Now that it's spoken very vaguely in verse 13, it wants to tell you a little bit more. And bring a spade with you. Like, you're supposed to walk around with a spade on as part of your girded armor. And it will be that when you sit down outside, dig a hole, go back, and cover your excrement. Yated. Yated it is, actually. A peg.
Yeah, it's a peg.
A peg, you're right, because that's actually smaller, and it's easier for digging deep, quickly.
So what are you discussing? It's a shovel.
It's not a spade.
It's a shovel. It's
yeah,
a
you're right. It's
shovel.
Actually
it's
not
a
spade.
No, no. It's a tent
What's
peg.
A trowel?
Oh, it's a tent peg.
It's a tent peg.
Okay, it's good enough. Makes a hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes a hole. It makes... I guess they're just, you know... Okay, let's go. The Septuagint... Wait. No, it is pasalos.
Yeah.
Yeah, also a peg. They translate it literally there. I think it's just, you know, in translation, you have to make sense of everything. And so in the context, you're digging a hole to bury something. So what do you use to dig a hole? Well, you use a shovel or a spade. But you're right, if they want to be more precise, I would have used tent peg or peg. I guess if you use the English word peg outside of the context of a tent, it wouldn't be quite clear what that was.
A long, straight thing.
Yeah, but it makes more sense. If you have a bunch of armor on you, you don't want to be carrying around a big shovel. You just need a little something metal that's hard enough that you can dig a hole quickly. Because you don't know when you're going
to
have to go outside the camp.
Then.
Yeah, you don't have to go all the way back to your tent to get some shovel, you know. You need something that's small. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of a Swiss Army knife that was created for military because you got it all there on this little thing that you can just hang on.
My question is this going out and covering up your excrement?
Yeah.
To put it politely, I'm not very good with these words.
Yeah.
Are we back at this, is this hygiene or are we back at ceremonial uncleanliness?
Well,
because it's still linked to keeping the tent, the camp holy.
Right.
But
so this is the interesting thing, yeah. It's...
It makes
seems more
sense.
Hygienic.
It's indecent.
Right. So now we have to try to say what is a common denominator between these two occurrences. One is for sure ceremonially unclean, and one is just, you know, yucky. And the rationale is, look, God's presence is with you. Don't let your camp be full of yuckiness. He doesn't want to step in crap. You know,
right.
Keep it outside.
Right.
I mean, that's what 15 says. Because God, the Lord your God, is walking around in the midst of your camp. It uses the word mithalech. This is the same word in Genesis 1 that the voice of the Lord walked around the garden with Adam and Eve.
Oh, wow.
So it's that concept of his presence is right there with you. Respect that fact and therefore make it look good. Treat him with respect and don't don't show him the stuff that normally we cover up and keep in our bedrooms or in our chamber pots.
Keep it presentable.
Exactly. And then it says, okay, so the Lord your God walks around in the midst of your camp to save you and to give your enemies before you. So, in Hebrew it's and, but it, with the concept of so then, your camp will be holy. And there shall not be in you the nakedness of a thing. Ervat davar.
Which verse are you
in? I'm in verse 15. So there will not be the nakedness of a thing, or some of you may have anything indecent.
I think it's 15.
Veshav me'acharecha. And that refers
to... translate, so I think you're in 40 for us,
are you? Oh, well, in Hebrew, it is 14 in English. In Hebrew, it's 15, in English, it's 14. We'll let that motorcycle go by. So don't let anything... the nakedness of a thing, and God will return from you, or return behind you, or return from behind you.
I've got turn away from you.
Turn away from you, and we're going to talk about that in a second. I guess we could talk about that now. I can read you from when God is lamenting that he put Saul as king. He said, let me read it. Shuv me'achare. That's this idiom. Oh, first he quotes Ruth. I'm reading from Da'at Mikra here. First he quotes Ruth, Al tifge'i vi le'ozvech la'shuv me'achareich. So in Ruth 1, verse 16, it says, don't hurt me to leave you, and then to leave you. It uses two idioms for leaving. And so it's like the one idiom interprets the other. And the second of those idioms is the same thing we have here. To return from after you. And then it quotes from 1 Samuel 15:11, when God says of Saul, I feel bad that I made him king. Nihamti ki himlachti et Shaul lemelech. Kishav me'acharai, because he has turned back from behind me. So the concept is he stopped following me, he has left me. And so that's how one of the Aramaic translations called Yonatan translates the Lord, the presence of the Lord will leave you if it finds this disgustingness with you. And the other translation of Aramaic says, the presence of the Lord will get behind you. I find that interesting. So he won't totally leave you, but he'll have to distance himself from you because of all the junk in your midst. So two takes on what this idiom would mean. But the bigger thing here is ervat davar. And this has been the key of much discussion, the nakedness of a thing. Erva is often used, it's literally nakedness. It's often used euphemistically as something of a sexual nature. So, for instance, if we look forward, we'll get to it, I guess, next week or so. Deuteronomy 24:1, if a man takes a woman and has sex with her, and it will be that he doesn't like her or that he finds the nakedness of a thing, ervat davar, it uses this exact same phrase, he can write her a certificate of divorce, and he can send her from his home. So this is the verse that engendered a lot of discussion in Jesus' day. And there were two big interpretations, one by the house of Hillel and one by the house of Shammai. Shammai was a more conservative. Hillel was very liberal in his understanding. But it all hinged on the meaning of what does this mean, ervat davar, the nakedness of a thing.
Could you write up the Hebrew on the wall?
does it mean a thing of nakedness, or does it mean nakedness of a thing? And why is that important? If it's just, if you take elva to be nakedness or indecency, the indecency of a thing, Hillel would argue, well, anything yucky, anything indecent, right? Anything indecent whatsoever, you can divorce your wife. And therefore, he gives the example, you know, if she burns your food, you can divorce her. You don't like it? Divorce her, whatever it is. So that's on the very extreme side of liberality. And then Shammai comes with the opposite, saying, what are you talking about? Erva is normally referring to nakedness. We're talking about sexual indecency. So it's got to be, you know, if there's any type of fornication, sex outside of marriage, that, the nakedness of a thing, that's what it means. And so Shammai says, no, you can only get a divorce if there's been adultery. Yeah.
Wait, that was that way? It was Shammai that was,
yeah.
Was
yeah.
very strict about
divorce, yeah.
Hillel said you can get divorced in
yep.
any
yeah.
instance?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that's not how we do liberal conservative. Yeah.
Okay, let's just say this. There were all these debates going on in Jesus' day. In some cases, Jesus tended more with Hillel because Hillel would represent also a more liberal idea of God's love and grace.
Right.
And so on some issues, Jesus lines up with Hillel.
Yeah.
On issues of divorce, he lines up with Shammai.
Because
right. he says no.
More compassionate. Shammai is being more compassionate.
To the woman.
The woman.
Yeah, yeah. And if you remember, Jesus says, yes, Moses allows for divorce because of the hardness of your heart,
yeah.
but ideally it was not so. You know,
right.
in the beginning it was, you know, man and woman become one, and that's it.
What was the logic of Hillel's thinking here? It's just
the nakedness of a thing, or the thing of nakedness, so to speak.
He got to this crazy idea of being able to purely from the deciphering of that term.
Yes, because this. A thing or event. So the nakedness of a thing, if you want to take this to be...
I mean, what I'm saying is, like, Hillel otherwise had this a very intact sense of the sanctity of marriage, but then they came across this term and said, oh, wait a minute.
No, you know, all of these texts, you read them how you want to read them, right?
Right, that's what I'm saying.
But what he's saying is here... It's really the main noun here is thing, which
yeah.
is very generic,
yeah.
right? And so the nakedness of a thing, if you're saying it's indecent, anything indecent.
Well, erva is also generic.
Erva can also be generic.
Right.
However, there is a sexual connotation. If you say erva,
yeah.
you're talking about nakedness, something that needs to be covered.
Yeah, you're not talking, usually you're not referring to indecency in any sense.
And actually, our text this morning is a context where you're using erva that is not sexual.
Mm.
Because you're talking about going to the bathroom in the middle of your camp.
Well,
you're talking about poop.
You gotta get naked to go poop, though.
No, you're right. So the connecting factor there is literal nakedness.
Yeah.
Both things, like usually you cover nakedness. It's not meant for public.
Right.
So it's in that way, it's a shameful thing, something you cover.
Yeah.
And so, but it's not strictly sexual.
Yeah.
Could you just recap for me briefly on Hillel and Shammai? I mean, I've got it written down. What you said was Hillel was the more liberal and Shammai was the more conservative and rigid.
Right.
And yet we see in Yeshua that he mixed both, and I'm not quite clear.
No, it depends on the issue at hand.
Right.
So on this issue of divorce, Yeshua lined up with the house of Shammai saying, don't get a divorce unless there's been some
adultery.
Some sexual indecency.
Like Jesus was usually with Hillel. Like Hillel was more lenient on Shabbat, for example. So Jesus
went
along with Hillel. And things like that. But here, Jesus goes with Shammai.
This example of no one's totally right.
Yeah.
Righteous and not totally righteous, and wicked and not totally wicked.
Yeah.
So, in just to give you some other context of this word erva, if you look in Isaiah 47:3, let your nakedness be exposed. My NET Bible translates, let your private parts be exposed. Your genitals will be on display. In Hebrew, the first time that's erva, nakedness, and the second time it's herpa, your shame. And not that bodies are shameful, but they're inappropriate for public display, let's say. So when it's talking about your shame, it means the parts that normally you need to be covered. And erva, we've mentioned it before, to uncover someone's nakedness is a euphemistic way of saying to sleep with them. We see that in the laws of Leviticus. If you look in Leviticus 20, a man who sleeps with the wife of his father, the nakedness of his father he has uncovered. He shall surely die. Leviticus 20, verse 11. But if you carry on that whole verse 17 and following, they have a list of nakednesses that you may not uncover. And it'll say, don't uncover his nakedness, it's his nakedness. And so it's all euphemistic language saying, don't sleep with family members, basically.
You know, just back to the thing about the excrement, you know, like, you'll clean a baby who's pooped his pants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in modern times, anyway, we will, right there in front of people.
At least here in this country, yeah. Right. Even on a public picnic table, we all change a diaper.
It never was like that.
In England?
No, but I remember being shocked, absolutely rigid, when I was really quite young, when a crazy Dutch aunt of mine adopted a child, and this child had a plastic see-through potty, which was set in the middle of the room, and we all had to watch. I was about 9 at the time, I think.
How old was the children who used this potty?
I imagine it was two.
Two, yeah.
Two. Wow. I don't know, 18 months. It was sitting on its body, and we had to watch it perform. And I remember being quite shocked as a child.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, right. The see-through feature is probably...
It was a see-through plastic potty, so you could see what happened.
Unnecessary. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that, like, you move the kid out of the living room when they get to an age of when their nakedness is...
Yeah.
...becomes... indecent. So
exactly.
It's like
it's
not. It's not the excrement per se that is the indecency. It's the nakedness of the
the mature person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You're right. However, there is that little follow up. You should go back and cover it.
Right. You do want to get that excrement out of there quick.
I was reading in this commentary. They were quoting from the Talmud and saying you should be. What's the word? Like, modest like a cat. Because, like, a cat goes back and covers up after itself. And so, this sense of covering what needs to be covered, basically. So, it goes on from there, and the next few rules don't relate, as I see it, to this same concept, but maybe it does. The whole slave thing.
Where's the part that I have?
In the beginning, right before our selection, verse 9. So it's right before our selection starts. But all of a sudden we have this slave. You know, this law seems particularly misplaced in a sense, but you could argue because we're in a context of war, you know, when do you find slaves escaping? It could very well be from the other army camp. I think of the when David finds the Egyptian slave that had been abandoned by Amalek. As Amalek is running away from Ziklag, they abandoned a sick slave, and David finds him. And so this law gets added here and says, you must not return an escaped slave to his master when he has run away to you. Indeed, he may live among you in any place he chooses, in whichever your villages he prefers. You must not oppress him. And to me, I was telling Gary this morning, this is like the biggest law you could use against slavery that I see. Although the Hebrew Bible allows for slavery because they live in cultures where that is taken as for granted, as a fact that there will be slaves. How do you treat them? This is how you treat them. Here is actually quite profound. If you really believed that the slave was actually property, you would be required to return his property. But here it's basically saying no. If he gets away, if he escapes and comes to you, just treat him like a free person. Let him live anywhere and don't oppress him. Basically, you can't enslave him then. You know, you don't oppress him.
Yeah, but, you know, it's lacking his context.
Yeah.
Like, why did he run away? Is
right.
he an Israelite, or is he...
Yeah, it's completely lacking context. But that's why I'm saying, I think the greater context is this going out to war, like the Egyptian slave they found, that kind of context, where slaves from your enemy camp. Yeah. Right, because it's trying to harmonize with other texts that say you can't have a slave from Israel, but you can have a slave from foreigners. So I think he's trying to harmonize those things together. But really, it doesn't tell us who this slave would be. Yeah, you have to interpret. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, the weird thing is if it were from your enemy, how would you have returned it anyway? Because you're not going to walk over to your enemy and say, here, have your slave.
I don't have anything.
I don't. It's stuck in here. It's like...
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just...
talking about this. Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't have enemy. I have... You shall not give back to his master... the slave
yeah.
who has escaped from his master too.
Yeah, no, it does. It does say master.
It's master in Hebrew.
Yeah, Adonav. No, we're just all trying to explain why this little law got stuck here in this context because it doesn't fit the context otherwise. We're not talking about slaves here. So the next ones. Okay, you could argue the next ones are kind of random as well. However, not completely, because. Lo tiye kdesha mibnot Israel, velo ye kadesh mibnei Israel, velo tavi et nan zona mechir kelev. Okay, so here it's very interesting because we have mention of a temple prostitute, and then a male, both female temple prostitute and male temple prostitute, and there are different ways of interpreting that. But if you remember when Judah goes to Tamar. Tamar says, you know, he comes back to pay Tamar after he slept with her, thinking she was a prostitute. And then when he comes to the place and she's not there, he asks other people, where is the, and he uses the word kdesha, because it sounds a little better than just prostitute. A temple prostitute is a prostitute with a purpose. So where's the kdesha? And so that's the word used here. But it's interesting because it also makes me think of the Midianites, you know, when in Baal Peor, you know, where they led the Israelites to bow down and worship their gods. I think there was some ritual. I don't know. Oftentimes, the god of war and fertility might go together, and so maybe in the context of war, you could also say you might have a cultic shrine go with you, and that involves sexual worship. But Israel is completely set apart from that, so. You know, even if you have a nocturnal mission, you get out of the camp. And then they keep going, and they're mentioning, you know, of course you don't have a temple prostitute, and either male or female. And you can't even use wages from that, anything to do with that, to come into God's house. And so there's a very clear division between sexuality and the worship of God. And so you can read between the lines that if God has to say that there's a very clear division, it means other people didn't think that there was, right? Or else he wouldn't have to say it. So we can infer that other people were trying to worship their gods by sleeping with them, and they were using profit made by this stuff to take to the gods as an offering. But the interesting thing here, it also uses in verse 19 in Hebrew, which would be 18. The female prostitute here is a zona, not a kdesha, so they got both words for prostitute. And mehir kelev. Everyone know what a kelev is?
Dog.
Male prostitute. It is. Literally, it's a dog. But apparently, it's the word used for male prostitute. And that's interesting because we have that mentioned in Revelation, right, Gary? The dogs?
Right.
Talks about dogs. And so people understand, in the context of a bunch of sins. And so it's understood to be a male prostitute.
Do you know the reference in Revelation, Gary?
Ah. You can find a few. Because these are an abomination to God. And then, but then you're right that it continues, you must not charge interest on a loan to your fellow Israelite. You know.
Revelation 22:15.
The last verse kind of is hanging there randomly, but it could be just a chain reaction where you brought in the one and then the other laws were connected to it. So they all end up here. Or the dogs themselves. Poor dogs. Dogs get a bad rap in many cultures. But I'll tell you that
it's a funny mixture,
there's a reason.
It's the same word.
What's that?
Kelev.
Kelev.
Kelev. Mehir kelev. The price of a kelev. Right, because the full verse is Lo tavi etnan zona, so etnan is specifically the wages of a zona, of a prostitute, and mehir kelev, the price of a dog. So it's not talking about buying a dog at a pet store here, you know?
But the word kelev is very confused because it means
it means
the same
dog.
Word, yeah, but it's the same word for the name.
No, 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 no. No. Has v'halila. No.
It sounds very close.
It sounds close.
Is it not written the same?
It's written with letters the same, but it's like saying these are the same word. Well, yeah, they sound the same, but they're not the same.
Right, okay.
Kalev, kalev. Lev is a heart. Right. Kalev is like a heart. It's something maybe courageous.
Right.
Kalev.
Wholehearted.
Wholehearted. Kelev goes back to the segalet kalb. There's no long e under lamed.
Okay.
So.
That's why your roots are dangerous.
Yeah. So roots are dangerous. Well, I mean, essentially what I'm saying is kalev, the word kalev would be a combination of this.
Right.
That the original root is levav. Kalev is kemo,
like
levav,
dog,
the heart.
Yeah.
Where kelev is the dog.
Etymological alchemy.
Yeah, so yeah.
And since my Hebrew is low code,
Kadesh?
Kufresh Shempei is a female prostitute.
Kadesha, yes.
Kadesha, because it's all the same word for
Kadesh.
Okay, so this is also interesting. They talk about the word Kadesha means like the holy one, literally, almost. Kedusha is holiness, and Kadosh, Kedosha could be holy, adjective. Kadesha is the temple prostitute. And yes, but the two ways, it's the exact same word used of Tamar when Judah goes to inquire, where is this temple prostitute? He says, where is the Kadesha? So people understand, when they hear Kadesha, they're not thinking holy, they're thinking temple prostitute.
But that is the same root.
It is the same root.
One who works in the holy temple, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's two ways, it could be one of those words like... when you talk about roots, there's a root like het, sin. Hu hata, he sinned. But le hate is to purify. It's kind of the opposite. So sometimes you have roots that in one form mean something, and in another it means the opposite. Or liskol. If you stone someone, it's liskol. So I'll just say sakal. But sikel is to get rid of the stones from the field. So one, you're stoning someone, one, you're getting rid of the stones. So you have several of these that are opposites.
So it's context, but if you think of the Kedusha one, this concept of being separate, I mean, after all this...
So you could argue it's also just separated for temple worship,
that's
and
right.
In idolatrous temple worship, it included prostitution.
I mean, she...
So it's either just the standard interpretation of separating out to be holy, understood paganly, or it's the opposite of holiness in correlation to the way roots are used there.
In Arabic, you have a nice one, haram is something that's forbidden.
Yeah.
It's also a word for harem.
Yeah.
So,
well, you have it in Hebrew, too.
Right. So your harem is the where you know, all the women were for the you know the rich person. So that's his harem. It's also the thing that's forbidden to everybody else. So
exactly.
Depending on what side of the wall you are.
Yeah.
You know.
And harem l'Adonai in the Bible is the same thing. It's set aside especially for God.
And what's the other word that was used for prostitution?
Zona, yes, for a woman. For the man, it was used kadesh and kelev. So, don't name your children kadesh or kelev. So, let's go to Isaiah and see how this connects. Starting in verse 16. Rahatsu, hizaku, wash, be purified, or cleanse yourself. Remove your sinful deeds from my sight. Stop sinning. Learn to do what is right. Promote justice, give the oppressed reason to celebrate, take up the cause of the orphan, defend the rights of the widow. Come, let's consider your options, says the Lord. Though your sins have stained you like the color red, you can become white like snow. Though they are as easy to see as the color scarlet, you can become white like wool. If you have a willing attitude and obey, then you will again eat the good crops of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword. Or you will be eaten by the sword, you could say, because there's a play there. Know for certain that the Lord has spoken. How tragic that the once faithful city has become a... What do you have? Prostitute. Echa haita lezona. Yeah. Harlot. Well, there you go. Really, you have a harlot? Does anyone... I guess people use that word still. Do they use that word still? Yeah? In what context? Would you say... Like... Yeah, I'm just wondering if outside the Bible, if anyone uses the word harlot.
No, you might use it in old-fashioned English. I don't know, Shakespeare, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, Shakespeare and the Bible. Because
she married a harlot.
Everybody understands, but you don't know.
You don't use, yeah. So, prostitute, I think, is more standard English today.
I think the implication of a prostitute is actually a narrower field. A harlot can be any woman who's not very nice.
Really?
Yeah, you can use it.
Just adulterous kind of.
Yeah, well, no, it's worse. You could talk about... You know, the woman who runs the college, she's a real harlot. I mean, you know,
really?
She talks nasty things about you and so on.
Gold digger.
Gold, yeah. You could use it like
really?
That in a much broader way. A harlot is very, I mean, a prostitute, in my mind, and understanding
specific.
English, is much more limited.
What about whore?
Whore and prostitute would be pretty much the same.
Whore and prostitute.
Don't you think, though, that whore sounds worse than prostitute? Or is that just me?
That's interesting that both of you have a sense of this word that's been lost to us already.
you've been too Middle Easternized. I mean, we're
no, I think it's because we're too young. It's a generation. It's a generation.
Yes. Yes.
We're
just having a different.
I don't know.
Not necessarily as a prostitute.
Right.
A whore is a more vulgar term.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Prostitute is more of a polite way of saying a whore.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now, a harlot could be a prostitute, could be a whore.
Yeah.
But a harlot can also be a woman who sold herself for money and position. She married wealth.
Yeah.
She married someone she really didn't love or care about, but she married him for the money.
That's yeah, right. Okay.
But then you also, in the same context, talk about a high-class prostitute.
Well, zona, if I were to relate that to the Hebrew, I'd say kdesha would be the nicer way to refer to a prostitute. Or maybe it would be more like a prostitute, whereas zona, I think more whore. Because even today, it's used as, to cuss someone out. You could call them, you could call them a zona or a benzona, and you can get into fights about it. And it's not polite language at all. So here Isaiah is using some strong language.
But here he's talking about the city.
Yes, Jerusalem, because. Because Jerusalem, in Hebrew, cities are female, so it lends itself nicely to female imagery, right? Echa haita lezona kiriya ne'emana.
Well, in Ezekiel 16,
birth
of Jerusalem,
it
refers to her as, he talks about covering her nakedness, and there's a bride, and her on the morning water.
There's blood. It's quite, Ezekiel takes it to a whole new level from Isaiah.
But it's interesting. You keep reading. Just keep going down.
Mle'ati mishpat tzedek yalin ba ve'ata meratzchim. Yeah.
No, keep reading.
So.
Where did you start?
I said. Where were we? Yeah.
But the interesting thing.
I'm asking you to read it. You want me to read it?
Yes, I want you to read it, please.
I can't hear the microphone, so.
Okay.
See how the faithful city has become a harlot. She once was full of justice, righteousness, used to dwell in her, but now murders. Your silver has become dross. Your choice wines diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels, companions of thieves, and they all love bribes and chase after gifts. They do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them.
Okay, sorry. Stop there. So she's a prostitute. What do prostitutes do?
They get money.
No, they take money.
They get money. That's what I mean.
They take money. And here, who's taking money?
Jerusalem. Or what? The Israel. For
the judges.
Right, for injustice, for abuse of power.
Yeah.
They are being called prostitutes.
Yeah, and it connects back to the wages of a prostitute.
Right.
You can't bring the wages of a prostitute into the house of the Lord. So Isaiah is basically saying, you're all prostitutes, and so your money is tainted, basically.
Mm-hmm. And you notice the very first verse of 16, it talks about washing, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Meratzim instead of rochatzim.
Yeah, versus washing versus murdering.
Mm-hmm.
Like in other words, when you take a bribe, it's as if you're killing someone. You know, it's
because
there are ways that people die because of stuff like that. You know, if you take money and you
well, especially in the context mentioned here about orphans and widows. You're vulnerable. If you take a bribe against them and don't defend their cause, they could easily die because of that, because they don't have money. They can't live on it.
I mean, it depends on the context, but often you see, there'll be these people, say, like India, where they were all poisoned because of a chemical plant. It wasn't back in the 90s. So many thousands, were poisoned because corruption and governmental position.
trying to cover up.
Politicians got money in their pockets.
Yeah. Yeah, politicians get paid off. That's what it's talking about here. And beautiful poetry in verse 23 in Hebrew, which is also verse 23 in English. Okay, we've evened out. Sarayich sorerim. Sarayich sorerim. Your ministers are rebels. Vehavre ganavim. Kulo ohev shohad. Friends of thieves, they all love bribery. Verodef shalmonim. This is the one I like because we're supposed to be rodfe shalom. We're supposed to pursue peace. And instead of pursuing peace, you hear the word he chose actually makes reminds you of peace. You shalmonim. You hear shalom. It's a more rare word for some kind of reward or gift. Payoff. Yeah. Rodef shalmonim, but it becomes that more powerful in the negative because you're thinking of what they should be in the positive. They should be chasing after peace, and instead they're chasing after payoffs.
Like instead of pursuing peace, you're pursuing piss.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly. Or pursuing payoff, or I don't know if there's some way you could say it where you hear the other one in your mind.
So the connection with the Deuteronomy is that Deuteronomy was more to do with ceremonial and getting it right. And even when you...
Well, there was both. In the Deuteronomy, we dealt with both, right?
Isaiah is a very... He's talking about ethics here.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'm trying to struggle with is that whereas we were reading first more about the keeping the ceremonial ways of keeping the place clean, whether it's to do with going out at night or taking a shovel or whatever you might be doing. And here we're saying, even if you're doing that, there is still a practical way that you can still be going after other things. You can still be not doing justice. You can still be chasing after.
Well, when you don't do justice and when you accept bribery, it's as if you are a prostitute. That's what he's saying.
Right. So you can be very busy keeping the prostitutes out of your camp, but you're still doing bribery, taking bribes, or treating people in such a way.
Yeah.
So that's really the connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why they get the two put together.
And the one word connection there is to wash, right?
Right.
Deuteronomy, Isaiah 16, and Deuteronomy 23.
Mm-hmm.
Or 11. Yeah,
and
11.
So he started off saying, you know, you're a zona and you're not a kirya ne'emana. So instead of being a faithful city, you are a prostitute city. Then if you jump down to verse 26, he says, but I am going to return your judges as in former days and your advisors like in the beginning. And after that, you're going to be called again the city of justice, the faithful city. So once again, you come back to this Kiriya ne'emana. And then you have this wonderful verse, Tzion bemishpat tipade. So, as for Tzion, Zion, bemishpat tipade. How is Zion going to be redeemed? With justice. If Zion does justice, it will be redeemed. That's how it's going to be redeemed.
Right, living righteously will bring about redemption.
Mm-hmm. Veshaveha, and her repenters will in righteousness.
Hodeh is the word also used for free and slave.
Yeah.
And if you think about again, the fact that running a slave,
yeah, you're being redeemed.
Redeemed,
set free, yeah.
Liberated.
Yeah. All right, so we're over time.
And can I make one little comment?
One comment, sure.
It seems to me, we always translate shalom as peace.
Mm-hmm.
the naming aesthetics conveys the idea of no conflict and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the English word well-being
is a little more holistic. Yeah.
Translation of the word shalom.
Yeah.
If you're seeking the well-being.
Well-being is better for shalom. Even sometimes wholeness can be.
Yeah, I mean, because well-being encompasses shalom encompasses.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also linked to shalom.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.